Let's go ahead and get going, folks, if we please could. We're now back in session. We have a time certain, item number 484. Carla, could you please read it?
Yes. Presentation by Metro staff on a potential regional affordable housing measure.
Very good. Colleagues, as you well know, Portland is in a housing emergency. In addressing this, we as a council have worked diligently with the community, with advocates and activists, to craft policy and incentive development to create more housing stock while simultaneously approving methods of stabilizing both renters and owners of housing units, with a specific emphasis on affordable housing and low-income renters and homeowners. We have approved a historic housing bond, which up to this point is put into our housing pipeline for development over half of the promised housing, nearly 600 units, within the first year of our 5 to 7 year schedule. And Portland Housing Bureau continues to aggressively move forward to create affordable rental opportunities. We've also continued production through our use of tax increment finance in urban renewal areas and partnered with area nonprofit organizations to create additional housing for the homeless, with a commitment to supportive housing, continued to produce housing for our veterans, Portland families, and our youth aging out of foster care, and of course, we look to do a lot more. Our housing emergency is marked by 4 consecutive years of 5% or more rent increases in the Portland area, with a smaller overall rent increase of 2% in 2017. We know that high-opportunity neighborhoods are becoming increasingly inaccessible for many families. We know that our fellow Portland families and residents of color are all but priced out of our most, according to our most recent State of the Housing report that outlined this. We know that Portland's population has increased by over 83,000 people between the years 2000 and 2015, and that growth is expected to continue. We're experiencing some growing pains as a city. I think we all agree on that. Colleagues, as one of our governance partners, Metro has created a draft framework plan in an effort to add additional resources to the Tri-County area through a potential housing bond. To present this framework, we welcome Jess Larson and Andy Shaw from Metro.
Thank you so much. We have a brief presentation and would love to then get your questions and feedback on the framework. You outlined the nature of the housing crisis here in the city of Portland, and as this map shows, it really is also a regional challenge. The growing pains of our region have created rent increases across the metro area, across many other regions across the country as well. So a couple years back, Metro began a process of examining the nature of the problem across the region, what cities like Portland and others in our jurisdiction are doing to solve the problem, and what role Metro could play. This last fall, our council directed us to move ahead to examine a potential bond measure for November of this year as one of the most appropriate things that Metro can do to supplement the work that cities and counties are already doing. So Jess, I think, is now going to
Good afternoon, Mayor, Commissioners. Thank you for the chance to be here. My name is Jess Larson. I'm in the Government Affairs Department with my colleague here, Andy Shaw, at Metro. So reiterating just a couple of details and diving a little bit more deeply into some of the elements of the framework, but doing so quite quickly so we can indeed hear from you your feedback and advice for Metro as we move forward. We are looking at a general obligation bond as the revenue mechanism, which will allow for capital financing of newly constructed affordable homes, as well as acquisition of existing housing that may be affordable today but may be lost in affordability on the market as the market changes throughout our region tomorrow. We also recognize that Metro is not a housing developer and has no intention of creating the bureaucracy to become a housing developer. In fact, we intend to lean on the existing capacity across the region, here especially the City of Portland and your partners at Home Forward, but also the other two housing authorities in Washington and Clackamas County, and 3 additional cities that act as CDBG entitlement cities, the City of Hillsborough, the City of Beaverton, the City of Gresham, which have much of this capacity already in place. So
just tell people what CDBG is.
Community Development Block Grant. Thank you, Commissioner. We've been convening this process for about the last 6 months, especially located at two advisory tables, one of technical experts from across the region and another of community stakeholder experts from across the region, totaling over 50 brilliant partners in this work to help give shape to the framework that we're going to present today. We've also had community engagement partnerships with many organizations across the region. We are having briefings such as this one across the region over the next few weeks to continue that refining the framework. And there is also a survey online, and we've had, I think, a couple of thousand community members weigh in on their advice to us as we convene this framework. So these are the elements of the framework, and I'm going to move quite quickly through them. We'll start with core values, the ideas that have really framed, given us the guiding principles for as we set forward to do this work. As all of the work at Metro is led with racial equity, the work of creating more affordable homes must especially be led by advancing racial equity in our communities. We know that much of the need for affordable housing is disproportionate experienced by communities of color, and the history of housing discrimination is long and dates back to the origination of our country. And so with this measure, we must begin to correct for those wrongs, otherwise risk perpetuating those inequities. So absolutely every part of this framework and all of the work going forward in implementation as a region will be led by racial equity. We've also committed to prioritize community members not otherwise served by the market. Of course, the need for housing affordability is wide in our region. All sorts of community members are struggling in this current market of ours in becoming a high-cost city, but we know the needs are disproportionately felt by communities of color, low-income community members, families with low wages, senior citizens on fixed incomes, community members with disabilities, etc. We've also heard a balance of priority around where to locate the new affordable homes, both in creating new access to new opportunities alongside transportation investments, for example, job centers, but also investing where communities with low incomes live today to prevent further displacement and neighborhood instability. And lastly, ensuring that we are being good stewards of limited resources with strong public oversight, administrative caps, which we'll talk further about here. We are proposing in this framework that with an investment of a $516.5 million general obligation bond, we can create homes for as many as 10,000 community members across the region and really tens of thousands of community members over the life of these future homes. We have a plan A and a plan B accounting for the possible outcome, two possible outcomes with the constitutional amendment with which voters will take up in November. So without the constitutional amendment passing, we can anticipate to build about 2,000 homes for about 6,300 individuals. And with the amendment, we can leverage both the partnerships of our nonprofit partners, but also low-income housing tax credits and other revenue tools with the general obligation bond, and thereby increase the outcomes both in homes and individuals served.
Jess, just hold this slide for a second. You know, this is very important for us to see, because what you're saying, and I'm assuming this is reasonably conservative, is that with the amendment, with the constitutional amendment and the allowing us to be more flexible with the dollars, we could potentially produce about 50% more housing. And I think it's very important that we all stick to this script, because there's been a range of numbers that I've heard in the last couple months. And I operate under the assumption generally that we should under-promise and over-perform. So this says 50%, and I hope that becomes the baseline for our public conversation.
Thank you. We appreciate that. And yes, indeed, we are working to set high goals, but to ensure that they are achievable goals. Certainly, there are opportunities for local jurisdictions to look at leveraging even further than what our modeling has proposed, but we did not want to require leveraging of all of our jurisdictional partners. So we've modeled modestly, if you will, to make sure that we are achieving further outcomes, but that are within reach across the region.
So I just want to second that. I would rather we go out with conservative or more conservative estimates of what we can actually produce in terms of volume and then prove ourselves to be better than that rather than going the other way. And so I would ask for us to make sure that we are very conservative, because what we're running into through our housing bureau is increased construction costs, increased housing stock costs, increased land costs, and general inflationary factors. And there's nothing the public hates more than being told they're going to get one thing and then find out they bought something less than that. So I'd really encourage, and the press will latch on to whatever our initial numbers are. They will hang on to that like a dog on a bone. They will not relent. So I would encourage us to be very, very conservative in as we roll this out. Commissioner Fritz.
I know we all have to be very careful about not advocating for things that are on the ballot, and the constitutional amendment is on the ballot. So as an elected official, I have a little bit more scope to get it wrong or a little bit leeway. So let me just explain that to folks who may be watching at home, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. The constitutional amendment that we'll all be voting on in November is to allow local bonds to be used for affordable housing created by non-profit or non-governmental entities. Currently, the Constitution says that if it's a public bond, the public entity has to own that in perpetuity. Is that approximately correct?
That's correct.
And that's the difference between whether we own and operate it is more expensive than if a non-profit or some other entity owns and operates it.
That is one element of the difference in and the goals that can be achieved. Another element is the requiring of the lending, the recurrent requirement that government shall not lend credit. And because of that, it makes it difficult to leverage other financing mechanisms like low-income housing tax credits under the current Constitution. So there are a couple of reasons why the constitutional amendment will allow for further outcomes.
And we want to be clear that we're not advocating for or against the amendment as public servants, but trying to accurately reflect what we think the outcomes would look like.
Thank you.
A quick reminder, the eligible activities under a general obligation bond are limited to capital financing only. So we're anticipating acquisition of buildings, acquisition of land, and the new construction of homes. And this is just further iterating the public ownership element that Commissioner Fritz just reminded us all of, so we can move forward in moving along. A finer point on some of these regional outcomes, beyond the number of homes and the number of people we aim to serve with this measure, we want to focus the goals to specifically serve those community members who struggle the most in our community to find affordable homes. So that means a focus on achieving as many homes at 30% median family income and below. We know that these are the hardest homes to create because they take the deepest public subsidy. Additionally, we have a goal to create at least half of the home size for families. Again, families are most struggling to find homes that they can afford in this market. A lot of the construction to date is one bedrooms and studios, and we need to make sure there are two, threes, and even four bedrooms available for larger families and intergenerational families in our community. In our measure, in this regional measure, we are recommending a affordability up to 80% MFI, but limiting that higher affordability range from 60 to 80% as 10% of the total bond proceeds to only construct at that level. This allows for deeper cross-subsidizing, for deeper affordability, and also allows for some homeownership opportunities in the event that the constitutional amendment passes.
Could I ask a question, and I don't know if this is a Jess or an Andy question or both. On the 30%, 45% of homes below 30% MFI, first of all, I'll just shamelessly say I'm in the camp that says the more 30% and below, the better. I'd frankly like to see it be a majority. I think it's a better talking point, and I think it gets at several issues that we're experiencing around housing affordability here locally. As you know, many people in the 0 to 30%, particularly the closer you get to 30%, are people on SSI, older adults, retirees. They don't necessarily need the housing support. Then, of course, there's the permanent supportive piece of 0 to 30, where we do have to talk about housing support. Do we have clarity yet, or is there a process through which the housing support piece of this would be clarified around permanent supportive housing for those who need housing support at the 0 to 30%?
We are not, and thank you, Mayor, for that question. We're not at this point requiring or recommending any specific goals around supportive housing, partially because a general obligation bond allows for only capital financing. So the supportive housing programming will be made possible through partnerships with our, especially our county, our three counties, who will help to partner and leverage those services in conjunction with the Future Homes. But we absolutely agree, and Metro is committed to finding to creating those partnerships and committing those resources in conjunction with these Future Homes so that we can ensure that we are serving the community members we intend to and ensure their success in affordable housing.
Great, because I, my suspicion is that that is a question that will have to be well-baked, particularly with regard to the county and the support services that are to be provided. Commissioner Udaley, did you have a question? I couldn't tell.
I do, yeah. I have a whole list of questions, but I think I'll just jump in as the subject arises. I agree with the mayor. I would really like to see the vast majority of these funds focused on 0 to 30, 50 at the highest. I think I know that there's an issue of the mix, I guess, of rental levels and ongoing funding and all that, and I'd love to gain a greater understanding, but in my reading of all the data, it seems that what we really need to do is focus our scant public dollars on those extremely low-income households who are at 0 to 30. 30 to 50 would be the next range. And that means we're getting people not just off the street and into that 0 to 30 housing, but out of unaffordable housing and into affordable housing, which then opens up that range of 50 to 80 that we still see a need, a much less great need in that 50 to 80 range. So I guess, you know, I'm interested in your thoughts on that and why. Why? I mean, I think we can do it, but if you think we can't, why? And I guess, yeah, I'll stick with that one question for
Great.
Now.
Thank you, Commissioner. And this goes back to Mayor, your question as well. You're absolutely right. The goal should be, and we believe is, to maximize the creation of homes at the 30% MFI and below. And it does take additional rent incomes to help cover those lower rents, because the rent that a 30% MFI household brings in is not enough to cover the monthly operating costs that tenant requires. And even if a building itself carries no debt and is fully financed or paid off, the operations aren't enough in the case of a 30% MFI apartment. So it does require cross-subsidy. In the case of the Portland general obligation bond, there was an opportunity to leverage the cross-subsidizing with a commitment of vouchers from the Portland Housing Bureau, from Home Forward. And that helped to achieve the goals of 45% MFI in the Portland bond. In our case, those vouchers are already committed from Home Forward to the current Portland bond. We have a commitment of 200 vouchers from Washington County and Clackamas County so far to help achieve those goals.
And yet
we're trying to achieve even more homes on the regional level. So that is part of the reason for needing a higher percent MFI, and actually recognizing that there's more work to do to identify ongoing operating cost resources to achieve these goals.
Yeah, I think it's just, I mean, it's a challenging equation, because I also don't want exclusively extremely low-income housing. I want mixed income housing. We all know that that's the standard to strive for. It's just, tough to see any of those dollars going towards housing that I think we could incentivize in the private market, and I'm talking about 60 to 80. Couldn't we feasibly come up with another revenue stream to be able to divert those dollars to 0 to 30?
Certainly, there are other revenue sources to talk about it.
Our
challenge is going to be working with you and others to identify the supportive housing services to match with these dollars in the months and years to come. So that's where we're focusing our energy on new resources. You know, as a regional program, we're hearing from nonprofits across the region who practice in this field that this is a pretty audacious goal to achieve. And getting some trepidation about the ability to have those rents maintain these buildings at those affordable levels for the duration for permanently. So we're trying to balance that deep affordability, larger bedrooms, with an ability to put some that are 60 to 80 and bring a little more rent into the picture for a particular building. That's the advice we've heard from our technical table, who's worked through some pretty significant modeling work to understand how we can get to the place where we are making a bold promise, but a promise that we can actually achieve.
Okay. I'm sure I'll have more questions. Thanks.
Let me just jump in for a sec. So I have the same concerns. I just want to approach it slightly differently. And first, I want to do a disclosure. I set three goals for this year. One is to win the primary, two is to beat cancer, and three is to work with our partners to pass the regional housing bond, maybe not in that order. And we got one down, and now I've agreed to serve on the PAC board, and I'm going to start doing fundraising with the mayor for this effort. So that's our next big challenge. I realize that in setting the framework for the bond, we have to be responsive to what our partners think. We have to be responsive to what we think will pass, get majority support from the voters. And we obviously want to set goals that we can achieve. That said, I can't remember a time when we didn't get pushback around permanent supportive housing. Let's just be clear. Every time this issue comes up, we get pushback, and it isn't just from one corner. Our nonprofit partners push back because sometimes the tenants that they serve are more challenging than others. Sometimes there are gaps in funding, both in terms of affordability and services, which they don't want to be saddled with. I mean, there's a whole host of reasons why even our nonprofit partners sometimes are resistant. My concern with the number of 45 is that, as with my colleagues, I think that should be more like a floor than a ceiling. And I think the one thing I'm hearing clearly from this body is that we're not sure 45 is the right number, but we would certainly not want to go below 45, and we would like to see if there's an argument for going above. And the question, so the answer is why, right? Why? Because we're not actually here talking about housing. We're talking about poverty. We're talking about very poor people that don't have choices, and either we provide them with stable housing or we continue to fund the most expensive and least efficient service delivery system ever devised by government, which is what we have as a default. So that's the choice, and I think the public now understands that, which is why permanent supportive housing has taken on. It's why the mayor, and I compliment him, set aside $3 million in his budget for services, of which $2 million will be really targeted to permanent supportive housing. So let me follow up on Commissioner Udaly's question and ask you, an obvious candidate for where we get those service dollars is the transient lodging tax. And so we are in conversations, the county, the city, and Metro. And, you know, there's millions of dollars that could be allocated to this. Are we getting close to a deal with the three jurisdictional partners to have a big chunk of that set aside to cover service dollars?
We are having a very positive conversation. In fact, Monday, I will be meeting with your staff and county staff to flesh out what a bucket in that bucket system might actually look like.
Okay. So, Mayor, having been to this rodeo a few times with our colleagues here, and I'm looking at Dan, who probably has been to this rodeo more than anyone else here, but just to put a fine point on it, I remember that every time we ever talked about a bucket involving the hospitality industry, it got complicated because people too many hands started getting into the bucket, and we started trying to solve too many worthy, laudable goals through the bucket. And I would urge us in this moment to be really focused on the challenge that's in front of us and not be seduced by the idea that a bucket can serve lots of different needs. Because if you do the math, and the math I'm operating under is for a typical unit where we need to buy down the affordability and provide the services, we're talking plus or minus $16,000. All right, so you do the math on that. That's $1.6 million just to get 100 units. So this is not cheap. Again, the alternative is so much more expensive. It's just that it's distributed to the system, and we pay for it in many, many different ways. That I would hope that building on the mayor's budget with the money he has set aside, that the three jurisdictional partners can really focus on the TLT side and carve out a big chunk for that. And then I think it's incumbent on our other metro regional partners to throw some money in the hopper. I mean, they are being benefited by this as well. So I would hope that the conversation extends to what can Clackamas and Washington County, for example, do? What resources can they bring to the table? Because we cannot fund a big chunk of this of these affordable units without the service dollars. And while it's not going to be the question before the voters, I think we have an obligation to identify the sources. And I'll close by recalling, I think, the first conversation that I ever had with Dan Saltzman about transportation. And I had been lulled into a false sense that Dan was the fiscal conservative on the council. And we were being asked under the Adams administration to go forward with the Orange Line, and yet we had no plan to pay for it. And Dan was enthusiastically voting to move forward. And I turned to him and said, because I thought at the time Dan was our fiscal conservative, I said, Dan, how can we say yes, give the yes sign to this Orange Line without knowing how to fund it? And he said, invariably, once we set the direction and we set the policy, we find the dollars. It becomes our priority to get those federal dollars, the local dollars, the match. He said, we're very resourceful, but we first have to set the vision. Well, that's what we've done with the 2,000 units of supportive housing. We set the vision, and we said we are going to fund it. And I think we should take the same approach to these service dollars here, that we should commit collectively to find those dollars so that this works. Mm-hmm. I'm seeing a nod, so I hope that's a positive.
You. So before you even answer that, just come back to the transient lodging tax, because I think we're getting a bit off track from this bond measure, which maybe we should get back on it. But could you make sure that I'm in the loop for the transient lodging tax, since I'm on the Visitor Development Fund board? I mean, we already get 6%, I believe, for the city's general fund from that. There isn't going to be any more money. So if we're going to divide it differently, that might mean less money.
This is new money that we are currently negotiating. And you and I are on the board, I think, that spends it. We're now talking about the revenue source.
We'd be happy to come and provide a briefing. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Yes. All right. So,
finishing up real quickly, the question of distribution of resources have been of great import across the region, wondering how the dollars will be distributed back to the local communities, and also how the goals of achieving these, creating these homes will be distributed. We, through very complicated process, have landed on a simple agreement and recommendation that the resources be distributed based on assessed value of homes, property tax base, to the three counties. But along with those resources come the commitment of Clackamas County achieving 21% of the goals and outcomes with this housing measure, as well as Multnomah County achieving 45% of the goals with 45% of the resources, and Washington County at 34% of resources and goals. Metro has a unique expertise to lend to the effort of achieving these goals, in that we currently operate a transient-oriented development program, specifically around land acquisition in conjunction with future transportation investments. And we're proposing that our role in contributing to the region's efforts in achieving those outcomes and creating these homes across the region will be through land acquisition. So we're proposing that 10% of the resources be spent by Metro acquiring land in partnership with 90% of those resources distributed across the region, as described in the previous slide, to our local partners who will be developing, owning, and operating the buildings.
Could I jump in on this one? So this one, as you know, is near and dear to my heart. I'm sorry we're nerding out after 4 o'clock in the afternoon on this stuff. But first of all, I want to applaud your focus on transit-oriented development. I think that is exactly the right kind of thing for Metro to be considering as part of this overall program. But I still have questions about anti-displacement strategies. Could you talk to me about that a little bit? And I want to give you a concrete example. There is a housing play that the Housing Bureau has been engaged in. It was brought to us initially by the community, and we have engaged a landlord. But once the landlord realizes the city of Portland's interested in it, he's basically jacking up the price to a ridiculous degree. So I'm worried about that impact. What have you thought about, or what is your strategy for thinking about how to develop an anti-displacement strategy where we're not paying top dollar?
Mm-hmm. So over time, our transit-oriented development program has been geared towards exactly getting ahead of the market. We know where we're planning light rail lines, where we're planning bus rapid transit, and we are able to use the limited federal dollars in the TOD program to acquire lands and to work with developers to add more density. Historically, that's been the focus. Recently, we've supported the development of over 800 units of affordable housing with the TOD program. So the concept is, and you were very close to this with the Southwest Corridor proposal, how do we blend resources into that proposal to acquire lands, sometimes acquire buildings, to get ahead of displacement that could occur when values rise after the investment is made. So Southwest Corridor is years out before it would actually open and have the kind of impact on real estate. So the ability to have this program in place that can work in Southwest Corridor, along Division, in other parts of the region where we're planning future transportation and transit improvements, that's the goal, is to get at that anti-displacement approach.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks.
And then finally, touching on oversight and administration, as with much of our experience in pulling together the framework for this measure, we are learning from the precedent and lessons learned through the current housing bond and your staff at the Portland Housing Bureau. We have done a comprehensive assessment of the capacity across the region to implement these resources in a near-term 5 to 7 year time frame. We believe that it is very reasonable to commit a cap to administrative costs at 7% at the regional level with all of the partners involved in administrating this program, both for oversight, compliance, the cost of transacting the bonds, etc. We are also recommending that a community oversight committee be appointed by Metro Council to oversee the regional program year by year, making sure we are tracking on the goals and outcomes we have committed to voters. And first, in order to prepare for the implementation of the measure, we will, following measure referral, begin to work with the partnering jurisdictions towards crafting intergovernmental agreements, which have a comprehensive local implementation strategy of how each jurisdiction intends to achieve the goals with their reserved revenue through this bond, and set forth a plan to start implementing as soon as after the measure is passed, following a brief community engagement process to vet all of those plans. So ensuring comprehensive oversight and efficient administration of the resources. And then I think the last slide is just where we are right now in our timeline, having briefings like this one today in community groups, other commissions and boards across the region. We convene the final two meetings of the technical and stakeholder advisory tables tomorrow and Monday. And the following Tuesday, the staff recommendation will be given by our COO, Martha Bennett, to our council for their consideration. And it is anticipated they will take up the vote for this measure and potentially refer it to voters on June 7th. So that is the completion of our presentation. We welcome any further advice or feedback or clarifying questions you may have.
Yeah. So is your 7% administrative cap written into the ballot measure?
Yes, okay. Indeed.
Yes.
Or will be.
Okay. Yes, that's the proposal, yes.
Okay, that's good.
So high opportunity areas, you know, proximity to schools, health care, parks, transportation, and the like, I assume this will give credence to that and investments in those areas.
So we heard a balance of both investing in communities where low-income families live, where communities of color live, where there's a common language spoken, where there are other kinds of cultural resources. That was one thing we heard. We also heard create opportunities in places where you're proximate to transit, where there are more jobs, where there are schools with lower dropout rates, et cetera. So the distribution method that we landed on, assessed value, is really a proxy for a very complicated set of formulas we used that map out where are opportunity neighborhoods and where are existing low-income households who are rent-burdened, where does the resource come from. And when you balance that all out, it was awfully close to assessed value. So that felt like a good way to distribute funds out to ensure that communities in Clackamas, communities in Washington, and in Multnomah County are all building homes in both existing communities where low-income families reside and in places where people may choose to move to take access to other opportunities.
Very good. Thank you. Colleagues, any further questions? Commissioner Udaly.
So we talked about this at one of the MPAC meetings, and I realize that some of what we want to do with the bond is contingent upon the constitutional amendment passing in the fall. I'm assuming you're being careful about crafting the language to kind of allow for either outcome.
Yes.
And has there been any more conversation about any of the bond money being utilized for land trusts or limited equity housing cooperatives, just to provide home ownership opportunities for low-income
households? Yes, we want to craft the measure in a way that allows for jurisdictions to explore that space of home ownership. It really only works if the Constitution is changed to allow the blending of nonprofit and public dollars or private and public dollars.
And then if... Oh, sorry, Jess, go ahead.
To clarify, home ownership in a land trust model, because we are committing to voters' permanency and affordability, and
absolutely,
that can only be achieved with a land trust.
Land trust. And if the amendment does pass, does that change the equation or the balance between 0 to 30, 30 to 60, 60 to 80?
Indeed, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Indeed, it makes it more challenging. The opportunity to leverage debt means the responsibility to pay back that debt, and it makes the goals towards deep affordability more challenging. We are doing very comprehensive analysis of all of the potential outcomes and opportunities and challenges of that reality, and are so far being working to solve for keeping the commitment to 0 to 30, which may mean leaving some debt unleveraged.
Yeah. And then my final question is, why 500,000 or 500 million? It seems low to me. Early polls showed that twice that has a good chance of passing with the voters. And I'm just concerned, you know, we're also hearing word of a $2 billion transit or light rail bond. I would like to see the reverse of that, frankly. I don't know how we can support that kind of an investment in light rail when we have seen a pattern of displacement around major transit projects and a reduction in ridership because those low-income community members are being replaced by more affluent residents who don't rely on public transportation. So a couple different issues at play there, but we shouldn't leave any money on the table with this one.
On the measure size question, we've heard from a number of quarters, go big, think larger than 500. We started with 500 as a sort of place to start and a modeling exercise. We moved it to $516 million because that, through the modeling work we did, we think we could achieve service to 10,000 people with the Constitution changing. We think that's pretty audacious, but we are hearing from folks, look at what you could do if you asked for more money. Just a comment on the polling. We tested a ballot title, and that got good results. We tested asking people, are you willing to spend $100 or $50 or $25? That got much more positive responses. But that's not the actual question that the voters vote on. They vote on the ballot title question. So we're trying to work to understand what's the appropriate amount in terms of what can get out the door through our partners, but also what the voters we think would be willing to invest.
But 516 isn't the last word. It may still...
It was the initial framework proposal. That's correct. And we're hearing a lot of folks suggest that we think north of that. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Is there a requirement to spend the money within a certain amount of time?
There is not... I'm not familiar with us in any of the bond measures that we've run in the past for parks or for the zoo or other places committing a time frame in the measure. We have talked about trying to spend the money in 5 to 7 years. Like the goals for how many units, the voters are going to hear that and will likely hold us to those commitments. But it's not something generally we've put in the requirements of the measure itself.
So, because the might. Probably you have looked at the capacity of the construction industry to handle $1 billion of construction in 5 to 7 years.
And multiple jurisdictions looking to acquire the right land and move through the development process, make sure the zoning is correct. So many steps along the way that just make it take some number of years to get these homes constructed. But we want to put a time clock on ourselves and on our local jurisdiction partners to get that money out the door in 5 to 7 years.
And since it's capital and it's on top of property tax limitations, we can do this one, get it very massively successful within 5 years, and then do another one.
Correct.
It's
and
not
it
like
doesn't
a levy.
Cause it doesn't it's not like a levy. It doesn't cause compression. It gets paid off over time. Yes.
Thank you.
Commissioner,
a couple more questions.
Sure.
You know, we've been watching the Portland Public School Board struggle with the fact that despite best intentions, there are market forces which make it difficult to meet certain commitments. Already, I think the mayor alluded to the inflation in construction costs. Mm-hmm. The flip side of that is if you hit a recession, there are projects that no longer go forward, and as Habitat learned with Mr. Gray's money, they could go and acquire land and land bank during a recession. But I think we have to be careful because I think the general consensus is that we may hit a bump in the market in the next few years. And while that may create some opportunities, it may also make it harder for us to do deals if tax credits become less affordable and blah, blah, blah. So I like the fact that it gives us the flexibility to, and that it's not committing to a specific arbitrary timeline because we're not smarter than the market. And the second thing I want to ask you, going back to the service side for a second, I seem to recall that Chair Kefouri said that she had some dollars as the county chair, which linked up with people coming out of prison or people in mental health crisis, where she might be able to program those dollars a little differently to put services with an apartment. And that was within her discretion. I wonder whether we're having the same conversations with the county chairs of the other counties as to whether they have some flexibility with dollars, again, people coming out of jail, mental health, and others, that could be reprogrammed to provide those services. Deborah has a clear understanding of where those pots of money are and how they relate to state funding, but I would encourage us to take a look at that.
Thank you, Commissioner. It's great advice.
Very good. Excellent presentation. Thank you for being here and
sharing. Thank you for taking the time today.
With us, and obviously to be continued.
Indeed. Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Colleagues, I'm going to shift this around a bit because I don't want to lose our quorum. Could we do 486 next, please?